This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
Starting a business can seem like a daunting task, unless you have a partner like Shopify. They have the tools you need to start and grow your business. From designing a website to marketing to selling and beyond, Shopify can help with everything you need. There's a reason millions of companies like Mattel, Heinz, and Allbirds continue to trust and use them. With Shopify on your side, turn your big business idea into... Sign up for your $1 per month trial at shopify.com/special offer.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Hunting Gear Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and we have a really good gear-focused BS session today with a run-and-gun whitetail hunter out of New Jersey. His name is Greg Litzinger, and he's known for like heavy scouting, run-and-gun whitetail hunting in some pretty high-pressure, crazy type terrain on the East Coast. And as we all know, the closer you get to the Atlantic Ocean, the more hunters there are, meaning pressured deer. So it's really important to do your scouting and come up with a game plan on how you're going to attack these animals. And Greg does it every single year, and he's a guy that I look at, respect, and I wanted to get him on the Hunting Gear Podcast here and talk about the gear that he uses, and not just the gear that he uses now, but the evolution from when he started hunting, what his gear was like, what his budget was like, to today. Just for an example, he talks about how he used to hunt from the ground, and then he got a tree stand, and then he got a lock-on lone wolf system, and now he runs a saddle, and just the evolution in products, everything from boots and clothing and arrows and broadheads and bows to what he's shooting today. So it's a really good BS conversation. We have some fun in this episode, and it's always cool on two parts here. It's always cool to look back at the gear that we used to use and laugh at it a little bit, and at the same time, see how others hunt
and the gear that they feel confident in. And like both myself and Greg say in this episode, it is about confidence. If you're confident in your equipment and you're not thinking about it at the moment of truth, then it's truly a good piece of equipment for you. So really good episode on, I must say, on this. But before we get into the episode, we're going to do a little commercial slot here. First commercial goes to The Average Conservationist. Now, The Average Conservationist not only is a podcast here on the Sportsman's Nation, but it is a apparel company that donates 10% of its earnings to a conservation effort. In some way, shape, or form. I think they, in the past, they've donated to the National Deer Association and some other local conservation orgs up in Michigan where Marcus, the owner, lives. And you say conservation, and sometimes you think not cool, but it's really cool. Their apparel line is badass, man. They have some really cool logo tees, some really good hats, hoodies. I'm a huge fan of their camo hoodie. They have an Average Conservationist hat. There's a big patch on the front that says The Average Conservationist. Huge fan of that hat. That's my number one. That's my go out to dinner with the wife hat. I'll say that. And what I will say is you need to go to The Average Conservationist, theaverageconservationist.com. Check out their lineup. Like I said, man, really high quality clothes. And the cool thing about their t-shirts, it's the dad bod make you look good t-shirt. So it's tight. I'm not going to say tight, but it's form fitting in the chest and arms, and it's loose around the gut, so it makes you look good. And they're soft, so I like that fact as well. And while you're there, why don't you use a discount code? And if I can find it here, it is NFC10, and that's going to get you 10% off of your purchase. So not only does it look good, but know that when you buy a hat or a hoodie or a shirt from The Average Conservationist, you're also, 10% of that is going back to conservation. So in a way, you're kind of donating to conservation yourself. So theaverageconservationist.com. And, it's funny that we're talking about this next brand, Lone Wolf Portable Tree Stands, because me and Greg both talk about how though that product specifically in this episode was really groundbreaking for us. It allowed us to change how we hunted. Right, it allowed us to be mobile hunters, and he talks about the Assault and Four Sticks. My favorite tree stand in the world is the Assault and Four Sticks, and that gets me anywhere I want to go. Crooked trees with a lot of branches, short, you can get as high as you want or as low as you want, and really you can customize it to the tree that you need to be in, not a close enough tree, but the right tree. And sometimes 5 yards can make a difference in the woods, right? So go to the internet and type in Lone Wolf Portable Tree Stands, man, and take a look at the Assault, take a look at the Alpha. That's a little bit bigger platform. I use the Alphas. What do I use the Alphas for? I use those more of a permanent set. So at the beginning of the season, I'll set the bigger platform Alphas up in historically good rut spots, like a staging area between a bedding area and a egg field, a staging area. I use them on some big travel corridors, some big pinch points, stuff that, if I can't get a buck pinned down or located, I go to my rut spots and kind of start from scratch. So those rut spots are Alphas, and the Assault and Four Sticks are my running gun setup. So Lone Wolf, man, go check them out. And I got a discount code here for you as well. So at checkout, enter the discount code 9FC21, and that's going to save you $50 off all purchases over $200. That is a really good deal, and that's shipped directly to your door, and it's a badass American-made company. So Lone Wolf Portable Tree Stands, and that's it. Let's get into today's, we'll call it a gear BS session with Greg Litzinger. All right, on the phone with me today, all the way from the East Coast, Greg Litzinger. Greg, what's up, man?
What's happening?
Oh, you know, just another dreary day in Iowa. I feel like we haven't had a lot of sun this spring, and it's been cold as shit here in Iowa, and I don't like it. I'm ready to get out and start putting trail cameras up and all that stuff.
It's cold today. Yesterday was really cold. It's sunny out, windy, but it's definitely cold here in Jersey too. Like, I left the house in shorts this morning. That was a terrible idea. You know, it's like that 2 a.m. wake up call. Like, I'm not paying attention. Step outside. Like, oh, that's cold. Get some of that. That'll wake you up real fast.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's backpedal a second, and I want to ask you, how was your 2020 season?
Pretty good. Shot 3 deer, 2 bucks, and a doe. I lost a really big deer, which was, I mean, bound to happen sooner or later. I think I made it, I don't know, 10 years before losing a deer. So
yeah,
I guess I was due, I guess, if you will. But fantastic season as far as, you know, killing and seeing and having a good time, making it fun again, I guess. I hate saying that word. Killing's not fun, but it was more enjoyable this year than it has been for me recently.
And why do you think that is?
I didn't have a lot of expectations. You know, I kind of went more, you know, as my buddy Clinton says, like freestyle, freelance hunting. Yeah. I had like certain areas, but I was pretty much just hunting to hunt, hunting, you know, fresh sign, just enjoying the moment, I guess, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you what, man. Do you run a lot of trail cameras?
I do. I've been getting into it more just because of family, you know. But yeah, this year I had probably about 12 out, I guess, off and on, never consistent. You know, I'll leave them out for a long length of time. Last year was the first year I actually was checking them a little bit more.
Yeah.
And that was kind of interesting. Yeah. I added a new method of hunting, I guess, because some areas definitely were off this year. So I'm kind of glad I didn't waste any time there. The cameras were like, yeah, this place is beat.
Yeah.
So that was nice. So I'm not, you know, wasting precious time, you know, hunting an area where there's not a mature deer that I like to shoot.
Well, I'll tell you this, man. I often think about what trail cameras have done for me and to me over the years. And it's like, okay, I got a picture of a buck. He's going to make the hit list. Now I have to go find a place to hunt him where, you know, I got this trail camera picture of him. And I go in there and I know he's in the area somewhere in some way, shape or form, because I got a trail camera picture, but now I have these expectations of this is the only buck I'm going to shoot. So either I let some not great bucks, but some decent bucks walk in hopes that this guy comes in, or I'm sitting in the tree and I'm sitting there going, well, if he comes, he comes. And if he doesn't, he doesn't. And back in the day, like what you're saying, this freestyle type hunting where I didn't have any knowledge. I just was going off fresh sign. I was getting into a tree in a pinch point or some terrain feature. And I was like, oh man, anything could happen right now. Anything could happen.
Yeah.
And anything could happen, you know, at any time really anyways, but there's a level of information that trail cameras have given me over the years that have taken away some of the, quote unquote surprises of deer that are in the area, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I'm in the same boat. I have some areas that I refuse to put cameras in because, I've been hunting them so long and like, I know what's out there. I know what that area is capable of having, like some of the salt marshes. Plus it's just a pain in the ass to set them, you know, I got to take the canoe in with the tide or whatever, but I don't want to know what's coming in.
Yeah.
I want to keep some areas that are just free open. So like you said, you don't know, you can expect the unexpected, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some areas I'll camera bomb, but there's some areas I just can't bring myself to do it because I don't want to know what's out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's how I am now. I am doing this cast a wide net type. I heard this, method, or this approach described by Bill Winkie as casting a large net. And then when you get a big buck or a mature buck or a hitless buck on camera, you bring your trail cameras into that area.
more trail cameras into the area to really hopefully refine a deer's movement. And like, I do that, but then I almost feel disappointed when he doesn't show up or I can't figure him out. And that deer could be anywhere, right? We don't have a camera on every tree. So, I don't know. I like trail cameras, but at the same time, they take away something, and I'm not quite sure what that is yet.
It's a surprise. Yeah. You know, when you go fishing, you know, you don't know what you're going to catch. You're just something big's at the end of the line. And, you know, I do a lot of fishing and, you know, from the bank and night fishing and whatnot, and you know, like saltwater fishing. So there's always that surprise factor. Like you hook into something big, but what is it? Don't know. You got to reel it in, figure out. So having some areas that, you know, I don't run cameras, it keeps me not knowing, I guess.
Yeah.
It's probably the best way to put it, and keeps it fresh and exciting for me.
Yeah, I feel you. Let's talk about gear today. And we've already talked a little bit about trail cameras now. So let's jump into the gear. And I kind of want to start way back. Right. How old were you when you first started bow hunting by yourself?
Right from Jump Street. I was 14 when I started, but my dad back then, like there was no buddy stands or two man ladder stands. My dad would be like, all right, sit here. I'll be back in 4 hours. Don't move.
Same here, man.
So it's like, you never know. Like, I don't know. Like, first time I ever pulled back on a deer, I didn't have my dad tell me when to pull back, when to do this, when to do that. Like, so I learned, hunting with my dad, but it was pretty much on my own. And my dad would drop me off, and my mom would drop me off a few times. You know, my parents were pretty cool with that. And by the time I was 15, the following year, I was hunting on my own, me and my buddy, more than my dad. We'd still hunt with my dad, but you want to hunt with your buddy, it's way cooler, you know?
Yeah.
Because maybe I just wanted to do things on my own, or I just wanted to hunt my own particular way. Like my dad was, he's great at sitting and waiting, but when you're a kid, you can't sit and wait. Like I want to move around.
Yeah.
So me and my dad, we butt heads a lot because he's like, sit still. Or like, I was watching you can't stop moving. I'm like, yeah, man, I'm 15 or 14. Like I can't sit still. It's not in the car.
I just drank a Mountain Dew. Of course I'm not sitting still.
Yeah, exactly.
So do you remember some of the first gear that you ever had, like your first bow or your first camo outfit or anything like that?
Hand-me-down army fatigues and a flannel jacket. Definitely nothing insulated. It was just layers upon layers. You know, 200-gram insulated leather boots or old Kmart rubber boots with steel shank, like no traction, the little lace at the top, you know. I had, you know, back then all the risers were wood. Like my first bow, I had a wooden riser, big old 2x4 grip on it, you know, aluminum arrows, flipper rest, you know, taking your pins, the little brass pins, dip them in the white paint, like it's going to make a difference.
Right.
But you did it anyway.
And every pin was independent. I remember back then, I had I think it was a 3-pin sight, and I didn't know anything about archery when I was like 13 years old, other than, all right, you stand here and then you try to adjust the, you know, I had some old timer teach me how to adjust the pins, and I had one pin way up here, and then my other pin was way left, and my other pin was way right, and I'm just like, God, this doesn't make sense, but for me, it's working, I guess.
And you know, shooting 20 yards is far.
Yeah.
Back then, like, I mean, first of all, the bows were slow, and I mean, I was shooting 35 pounds, maybe 40 pounds when I was that age. So it's like 20 yards is like, it's always noisy. Both like, bang, and it's like this giant arc, and you're like, I'm shooting 20 yards is actually an arc on your arrow. It's so slow. It could simpler time shooting finger tabs, no releases. You know, pull back a bow at 50% let off with just fingers.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yep.
Good times.
Yep. I can remember the first time I forgot my release back in the truck, and I tried to do the fingers, and it hurt so bad. It hurt my fingers so bad, and I thought I was tough, and then I realized I wasn't tough anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And the old, when releases first came out, they had the little metal D-loop. You know, they were
oh,
out.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were cool, you know, and rubber peep tubes breaking,
yep,
snapping you in the eye. Yeah, good times.
Yeah.
Good times.
I heard a conversation a while back where they were talking about if you took some of the first compound bows and had they said that there was clickers on them, so you know when you had to get the cable changed, or it, because if it went too many times, it might break and you might get stitches in your face.
Yeah. The teardrop cables, you know, it's like, oh, I got to change the drawing. Just put a longer teardrop or a longer string on it. Just mess the whole timing up on the bow.
Yep, absolutely.
So archaic.
Yeah.
People don't know how good they have it today.
And I mentioned this in another podcast. Even if you go 2 or 3 years these days, and you shoot your bow and you're like, oh man, I love my bow. And then you grab the new flagship model from whatever brand and you shoot it compared to whatever bow you had 4 years ago. You're just like, holy smokes, man. It's still, even in that short of time, it's day and night difference.
Yeah. I used to compete archery, and my coach at the time had the flagship Hoyt, and I used to be like, it's just a bow. I competed with a hunting bow. So I actually shot his bow one day, and I was like, wow, there really is a difference. Like, the engineering that goes in, you know, behind it, and I'm like, this is nice. So I was like, how much does this cost? And I was like, that's too much for me. I was like, I'll just keep my bow.
Yeah. Now, as you know, army fatigues, hand-me-down bow, all that stuff. Do you, aluminum arrows, do you remember your first broadhead?
Thunderheads.
Yep. Popular. Yep.
Thunderhead 125. And actually, it's funny. I'm looking at a bow I bought when I was 17. Old High Country. I still got aluminum arrows. I got Thunderhead. They're 125s. I got feathers with a helical, and I shot like a flip arrest with shooting with a release. Like a very simple, basic bow, 70 pounds. And I mean, you look at the heavy arrow craze now, like in high school, I shot 70 pounds, 25 14s with Thunderhead 160s. You know, it was probably like a 700, 650 grain arrow, you know?
Right.
And it was like, people now are like, oh, heavy arrows are a thing. I'm like, been there, done that, man, long time ago.
Yeah. And there was actually arch in archery, you know, like what you said earlier, there, you would see the arrow curve down and it wasn't going very fast, but it was arching to where, wherever it goes. And now it's just rockets everywhere.
Yeah. It's cause I grew up in that archery was nothing. And then it was just on the beginning of becoming something.
Yeah.
And I remember the first, carbon arrows, the old Beemans with the outserts. And I remember shooting a deer with a carbon arrow. I was proud to be 19 when I shot carbon the first time. And I could shoot out to 30 yards with one pin. And I was like, this is the greatest thing ever.
Yeah.
One pin out to 30 yards, hold it high for 30, you know, at 15, hold it low. One pin was great. And I remember zipping through this buck, biggest buck at the time. He just jumped up. I'm just watching the blood pour out. He didn't even know what happened. Like, it was like so fast and the broadhead was so sharp. He didn't even know he was hit. He was like looking around and like he took a couple of steps and fell over. I'm like, this is so cool. Because before, the aluminum arrows, it was just like straight weight. Like, the deer knew it was getting hit.
Yeah.
You know, to get hit by the Mack truck. And then I zip right through him and he didn't even know. It was pretty, pretty cool.
And I bet you felt like a badass at that point.
Oh, absolutely. I was cutting from the ground.
Yeah.
You know, I shot him and I'm like, I'm king of the world, you know, drive around town, tailgate down.
Check this out, guys.
What
was, do you have a memory of maybe a bow or a piece of gear when you were younger that you're like, man, I really need this. I don't have money for it right now, but I'm going to save. And then you went out and bought it.
It was, had to be like halfway through my first season. I was so small when I was 14, I was 10. And my dad had Baker tree stands, bear hug, you climb up the tree and death traps basically. I was so weak and small, like I couldn't climb up the tree. So I bought a 6-pound hang on, those bolt together hang on from Bass Pro Shops or Cabela's. And I bought a few screwing steps, and then I had a couple rope steps. I think my dad made them out of like 2x4s or something, ropes or whatever, and made like a little Chinese finger thing, like tie on them. And I thought that was so cool because I could actually hunt in a tree. I'd have to sit there, you know, screwing the steps, you know, which sucked, and then like do these little block steps and come with other rope steps. But to be able to actually hunt from a tree with a little 6-pound hang on, I thought was pretty gnarly.
Yeah. So the first purchase was a tree stand.
Yeah, that I remember purchasing for myself. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
My dad got my first bow, and that was mid season. I was like, because I was always hunting on the ground. And it's like, you know, I can't sit still, man.
Yeah.
I need to get up in the air. And so I bought that, and then that was, you know, pretty cool to be able to sit above and have deer come underneath you and stuff like that.
Yeah. What did that do to you? Did it lead to any type of success or a new way of thinking? You know, we know you now as this very mobile hunter. Was that the start of it, or?
Yeah. Like my father, like we never hunted the same, cause I've always hunted public. I never had access to private, you know, never really until I was way older. So we always hunted a little bit of public, and we'd always hunt a different spot. So I was mobile before I knew what mobile was, I guess, because every time we went out, it was a new spot, either by canoe or, you know, get dropped off and had the mom pick us up. But having that tree stand allowed me to get to areas, you know, or see and stuff like that. So I guess that would be, you know, I guess the start of it. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So this tree stand kind of led you to being a little bit more mobile. Was that a climber at all?
No, it was a hang on.
A hang on. Okay.
What
were you using for the actual to gain elevation? Was there sticks?
Like screwing steps. Okay. You know, which were illegal at the time, but I don't know. I was a kid.
Yeah.
So I just used, every time I went out, I had to do screwing steps, which is awful.
Yeah.
You know, go 15 feet, you got, you know, 8-9 steps, and it takes me a half hour to set a tree stand, basically.
Yeah.
I couldn't hunt oaks. I couldn't hunt oaks because I'd be screwing all day, like getting nowhere. Like I've literally set up before, like 6 feet off the ground, because I got tired of screwing steps.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you this, man. Back in the day, I was on a farm where I had this giant tree, and it was too big to put the lone wolf straps around. Right. It's, mm-hmm. I mean, it's a big tree, and it didn't start getting thinner till up at the top. So I had to go buy some, screwing steps, those green ones from like Walmart or wherever. And they're not sharp. Back then they weren't sharp. Yep. And so you're sitting there having to put all your weight into it and try to get it just to get it started. But all it's doing is boring out this hole, and you can't even get, you can't even get past the bark. And finally, like you said, it took me 45 minutes to get 3 or 4 steps in. And I was just like, fuck it. I'm going to try to climb this tree and with my hang on my back, stand on a limb and just put it up somewhere. So.
Yeah. It's, and I think the following, when I was 16, my dad bought me, you know, a Loggy Bayou climber. And that was, you know, super light. You know, I could climb and bear, you know, old bear hugging trees back in the days, you know. I had abs of steel at 16. I had abs before everybody knew what abs was.
Or was that because you said you were small, too?
Yeah, both.
So, now as you started getting older, like how old were you when you started this to see success from the gear that led you to be more mobile? How old were you?
I think at 15, I killed my first deer, was a buck, and I shot him in the area we scouted all summer, and that was with the hang on.
Yeah,
I put the screwing steps in and. That was the first deer I ever killed, was from that stand. And then when I got to Loggy Bayou, it was literally a lot easier. I can hunt a lot more, and I got bigger and stronger, but I can get up 20 feet. It allowed me, you know, 18 and 20 feet was, I would say, I hate using the word game changer, but you got out of deer sight. So I started killing a lot more because I was just up out of sight. You know, I wasn't 12 feet anymore. I was 20. And it's like, wow. And then probably when I got about 18, I had 30 foot of haul line. And I would, a few trees, like, because you'd set the log you buy you up. I'd set up like 6 feet off the ground, the stand be like pointing straight up because I know I'm going 30 feet. I'll just go 30 feet. You know, like, so sketchy, not using safety belt climbing, like, just everything you should not be doing.
Yeah.
I did. Because we just didn't know, you know, it wasn't what we have now.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was, I mean, I wouldn't say it was a massacre, but, I mean, there was some seasons. It was all about numbers. It wasn't about bucks. I mean, kill 5, 6 deer a year with a bow. Just because you're 30 feet up, you're not getting winded, you're not getting seen, you know.
Right.
It was like a contest, who can hunt the highest.
Right.
It's so sketchy.
And at that height, man, there, I don't think scent really plays a big issue at all.
No, definitely not. I mean, when I was hunting that high, I hardly ever got winded. I would actually get seen because you skyline yourself so high, deer would be like, what the fuck is that up there? because you're like out of the tree line, you know? So it's like, wait a minute, hunting too high, can you get seen instead of smelled, you know?
Right.
So yeah.
All right. So as you start to, you know, it sounds like this tree stand allowed you to have more success just from getting higher off the ground and stuff like that.
Yeah.
How old were you then when you started, I guess, when would you say you were the Greg that we all know now? Like, how old were you when you started doing this heavy scouting, when you were real mobile, and roughly how old were you then?
Let's see. I was 33. So I hunted 19 years before I killed a quote unquote big deer. So I struggled for 19 years to kill. You know, I killed deer, but they weren't like big deer. What, you know, people say big deer.
Yeah.
So figure 30. About 30 is when I really started taking things serious.
Okay.
Like, cause I hunt and all my friends are killing these deer. And like, cause I snowboard, I did all these, like I had a lot of other things. I fished, I snowboarded, I turkey hunted, you know, all these things. So about 30, I started taking some things seriously. And it's like, I want to kill a big deer.
Yeah.
Like, I'm tired of killing a year and a half, 2.5 year olds. Like, I want to kill a 3.5,
yeah,
a 4.5. And that's when just reading the internet, the forums, archery talk back in the day, you know, was phenomenal. I learned a lot, you know, Eberhard's books, Greg Miller's books, the old Miles Keller, you know, the old Moon Guide,
yep,
stuff like that, Moonstruck, I think it was.
Yep.
And I would just immerse myself in that and just spend every chance I get in the woods.
Yeah.
You know, and that's when, you know, I guess the bow hunting theme was born, probably.
Yeah.
30.
So around that time when you said to yourself, hey man, I want to go after mature bucks. It's going to take, you knew it was going to take a different mentality and a different approach to it. As you made that change, did you make any investments in your gear to upgrade or drop some coin on, you know, a new bow or a new tree stand or a new camo or anything like that?
Lone Wolf Climber was the first. So like I said, the loggy bio was noisy, and I remember I was probably 25, 24 maybe, when I used, probably 21, I used a original Lone Wolf Climber with this guy in a club, and I'm like, this thing is silent. Two-piece, you're not bear hugging a tree.
Yeah.
And I, you know, back then I didn't have a lot of money. It took me like 2 years to save up to get the climber. And then that was like the, all right, this is quiet. I like this. I can literally climb up and see deer and they don't move. And then I wanted to transition into hunting, they said closer to bedding areas. And the climber's still kind of noisy. And that's when I bought the Lone Wolf hang on and sticks. I was 24, I think, when I got them, 25, the hang on. And that was the biggest boost for me as far as being able to learn how to set up or get in trees. I never could hunt it before because I always had climbers.
Yeah.
So, you know, 25, 26, the hang on came into play.
Yeah.
And then all that kind of like wrapped up into one where I'm like, all right, you know, and I spent a a good time learning how to use it properly.
Yeah. I have no facts or any type of statistics to back this comment up. So take it with a grain of salt. But I would say, I mean, every big buck killer that I knew back in the day when I was younger, early 20s, late teens, was using a lone wolf hang on and sticks. And these guys were slaying giants every single year. So I said to myself, hey, man, I got to try to get one of these someday. And so when I say that, I bet you that that original lone wolf is probably the sticks and the hang ons are probably led to the demise of some of the biggest deer nobody's ever heard of.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that, because like I said, a bow, I mean, isn't going to make you a killer necessarily, but being able to set up quietly, and because I mean, my Logie Bayou, I mean, to this day, there's three deer from hunting a Logie Bayou that the stand creaked, that they were 10 yards and you go to shift and stand creaks and the buck runs.
Yep.
Three bucks to this day that I wouldn't say haunt me, but I still think about those deer, and it's like, fuck. And if I would have had the lone wolf climber, those three deer, I would have killed my first big deer at 19 years old.
Yeah.
20 years old, like a mega giant, you know, I don't even have a deer in the wall that's that big now. There's giant 10 pointer. And I had him in range, you know, three or four times, and the stand, you know, stand got me.
Yep.
You know, the Logie Bayou just got me, and it's like, fuck, it sucks.
Yeah.
You know, and then have it happen like a few more times, and the lone wolf, I've never had an issue with a cast platform.
Yeah. And that's, I'll tell you right now, man, that product right there taught me a lot about big bucks. It allowed me to get closer to just see deer behavior. And once a guy can, and this is in my opinion, but once a guy can start learning deer behavior, it opens up a whole nother window of thought process, how he can get on, you know, it's like, oh my God, he's calm when I'm right here, or he's aggressive in this scenario, or look how this buck acts in a group of does versus a bachelor group or whatever. And it's just like, hey, I can get away with this, or I can, you know, take this access route or whatever. And I don't know, man, that product right there is the reason I'm a mobile hunter.
Yeah. My buddy Clint, he came up with this one, him and I did, he called it like mobile stealth. Like today's technology allows people to be stealthy, but also mobile.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, cause I used to carry four sticks, even sometimes five sticks and hang on. Dude, that shit's heavy, man.
Yeah.
Like, that shit'll wear you out. And I hunt all public. I have so many trailheads. You know, I'm a mile into the marsh, coming across this marsh, all this weight. And, like, my transition from what I used then to what I use now is great, because, you know, I'm a saddle guy and a small platform.
Yeah.
And I've adapted to that pretty well. And that's allowed me to get in some areas that hang on and sticks, it's a pain in the ass to get to.
Yeah.
It kind of streamlined the process for me, if you will.
Yeah. So, you know, what led you to take that next step into the saddle then from a lone wolf and sticks into a saddle?
I had old school, lone wolf assassin harness and platform I used for years. And that was great for a little hour to sit, you know, that was in the marsh, you're only 3 feet off the ground. I don't need a big, you know, or hunt some thickets, you know, or field overgrown field. You're literally, you know, 3 feet off the ground. So the assassin platform was what got me into that method, I guess, of facing the tree and using a harness. And then the trophy line diaper thing came out. I bought one of them used. And I hated it. It was uncomfortable. It was bulky. I'm like, I'm not saving any weight. And then I was sent a saddle. And that was like, wow, the new stuff is pretty legit, you know? And it was a learning curve. I had a big learning curve with it. I mean, the saddle cost me a few does.
Yeah.
You know, the first season, I really wasn't a fan of it, because, you know, you're used to hunting a certain way for so long. And it's like, oh, here's this. how to set it up and when to set it up, you know, when to move. But now I got to kind of figure it out, you know, what works for me.
Yeah.
Saddle wise.
Yeah. So now, you know, like you see these evolutions in products or maybe not even an evolution, but like a method change of how you approach hunting.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you go from this noisy climber to a tree stand. You went from one noisy tree stand to a quiet tree stand. You went from a really good tree stand to the saddle method. Do you think there's anything after a saddle that can be done? Because there was a saddle craze back in the day. I think it was in the 90s at some point. You know, and a lot of guys were like, oh, no way that works. And obviously now there's a bigger channel to distribute that information of how a saddle can be, you know, could help a guy. Do you see from using a saddle that there is potential for something lighter, faster, quicker, and does the same job of what you're currently doing?
I hunt with a lot of older guys, and there a lot of the guys I hunt that, you know, they transition to recurve and they transition to ground hunting only. They do it for the challenge. As far as like saddle, I mean, you can make it thinner and lighter. You know, there's going to be always lighter fabrics out, but how light can you really get it? Yeah. You know, that's still comfortable. You know, you can have ultralight anything, even like some of the micro tree stands. You know, like my buddy's got the Lumov Custom 0.5, the little mini one.
Yep.
Like I got size 11 boots.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to hunt out of that thing for any length of time. It's just like, well, this just doesn't fit me. You know, I don't have much movement on the actual platform, you know, and I'm a little guy, but it's like by the time I put rubber boots on, I'm like, yeah, can't go smaller and you can't really get much lighter and be safe, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess you could, you know, materials are always changing, but I mean, that's where we're at now. The machining, we have the capability to machine better products now, water jet and stuff like that. So you can actually have a smaller, you know, less material, water jetted out at a piece of a piece of steel or aluminum. But as far as getting any lighter, I just don't know.
Yeah.
Carbon fiber. I mean, that's the next evolution. I would say, you know, I know they got the carbon fiber sticks that are out and some other carbon fiber products. So carbon fiber, some type of impact resistant resin, carbon fiber, maybe.
Yeah. Something that's going to be quiet and, you know, cause you know, I've got carbon fiber things in my house and tools that I use. But then you start talking about cost, right? And at what point it's like, for example, you know, some of these tree stands are on the market. You can get like a Lone Wolf right now is $250, roughly for an assault or something. I don't know, $230 or $250 for, you know, the Lone Wolves. But then like the beast stand is way more expensive than that. And that's expensive. So there's got to be a point from a business standpoint where it's like, Jesus, man, a $700 or $800 tree stand, there's no way I would do it unless it's so functional that it's a no-brainer to use the style that a running gun guy would use it.
Yeah, I look at it from like the diehards, you know. The diehards, like, I mean, I got my Lone Wolf hang on damn near 2 decades.
Yeah.
I'll never get rid of it.
Yep.
It's still going to stay here. I'll probably hardly ever use it or rarely use it, but it's an investment. I've had it for 20 years. It's the only, you know, outside of my old bow I got looking at, you know, I could still use it. 20 years from now, that stand could still work.
Yeah.
So it's an investment. You buy it one and done. But like I said, from a business standpoint, how are you going to make money when you've literally built the ultimate hang on, you know, like Dan, like his beast, like that stand's pretty legit.
Yeah.
Well, you buy once and you're done. These guys that buy like stands, like it's like a bow. Bows really haven't changed these last, you know, in the last 5 years. You know, they tweak it a little bit quieter, but like a stand, you know, you get it so light and so perfect. How do you sustain making money on it? Which is something I always thought how businesses could stay afloat, you know, at that cost. But then again, you're buying it, and I guess people are buying them. If they're making them, that means there's a market for them.
Yep, absolutely. So, you know, let's talk about clothing for a second, because I'd love to hear your take on this. Like, whether it's staying warm or dry or cool, depending on what kind of scenario you're hunting in, what are you looking for a apparel or outfit walking into the timber, the style of hunting that you hunt, and how do you break down your garments?
I would, you know, I'm a sweater. I don't know why in the wintertime, like, cause I walk pretty far. So I have to, even in the wintertime, I'm wearing ultralight stuff out. And in summertime, it's not too bad, or fall, early fall. But as the season progresses, it gets harder and harder for me because I'm packing so much, you know, on like compression strapping so many clothing onto my backpack, it's becoming a little bit bulky, a little bit cumbersome, because I streamline down to a backpack and a saddle, but now I got all this extra gear on it. So for me, I'm kind of torn right now with gear, because I like some of the clothing that's out, but I'm also cheap.
Yeah.
So I wish somebody would make like a functional one piece coverall, windproof, quiet, everything you want. That way I can just roll it up, carry it underneath my arm or something, and be ready to go. That's what Sitka First Light coveralls, man. The warmest thing out there.
Yeah. Well, I tell you this, man, it's almost like, have you ever hunted out of, what are those heater body suits?
I borrow my buddy's IWOM, which is basically the same thing.
Yeah.
When I hunted out of tree stand, but in the saddle, those things aren't the best.
Right.
You kind of lose a little bit of mobility because they're kind of bulky.
Yeah.
So that's, I would love that he's got the Predator Fall Gray IWOM. I mean, in the late season, December, I mean, that thing looks great up in the tree.
Yeah.
Such a great camo pattern. And he's always warm. And it's like, man, I really wish I could have one of those things.
Yeah.
Because I hate being cold. Being cold's the worst.
It is.
Yeah, you know, I'd rather just sweat to death than being cold. When you're freezing, it makes for a 3-hour sit seems like it's an eternity.
Yeah. Yep. I feel you, man. So you wish that there was a full body coverall that you would put on at the base of the stand before you put on your saddle.
Yeah. Okay. You know, old school coverall, you know, cause I use them for work. Sometimes I got to work outside at work. Just a lightly insulated Carhartt coverall keeps you warm.
Yeah.
You know, keeps you warm. Like it's like a giant sleeping bag, man. You need to stay warm.
Yeah.
But if they can make it thin, quiet, and like for the bow hunter, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
Be like someone like if Sitka designed the coverall, or First Light, people that got like all the smarts, all the brains, designers, make it slim and trim, they could sell, man.
Yeah.
They could sell a ton, because I've tried Sitka gear stuff on. It's nice, but I can't spend that type of money for bibs and a jacket.
Yeah.
I just can't do it. Or like even like some of the First Light stuff, like $250, $300 for a pair of pants. I can't do it.
Yeah.
Just can't do it, because I tear my clothing up. I mean, all my gear gets just destroyed.
Yeah.
I mean, I might get 3 or 4 years out of it. And I'm like, I had to buy $900 worth of gear every couple of years, I'd probably go insane.
Yeah. Well, and there's like, I've found this out in the last couple of years. There are other products out there that do the same exact thing, and they're not, I guess you would say, hunting specific, right? They don't have a camo pattern. Like this year, my entire season was done in solid colors. I had a brown sweater from LL Bean. I had some, basically they were
Donnie Vincent style.
Yeah. And everything was exactly the same. I shot my deer from the ground, this year. I had a lot of encounters, you know, while I was in my tree stand and all this stuff, man. I'm telling you right now, I don't think that camo is as important. Even my mule deer hunts out west, I don't think camo is as important as people think it is.
No. I mean, you look at, deer aren't camo. They're just brown.
Yeah.
You know, ducks, I mean, they're lightly heat to them. And, look at natural deer camo.
Yep.
You know, like I hunt with some guy, I know some guys that hunt, and if they're not moving in the woods wearing that stuff, you can't see them. they just disappear. They blend into nothing.
Yeah.
They're like, or your eyes just don't pick up on it. It's like, is that a person? You know, and you're only 34 yards away. It's like, you know, and then you see him like move his hand. You're like, oh, there he is. You know, because it looks out of place, but then you're like, wait a minute. There's nothing there.
Yeah.
And then they see a hand move like, oh, shit, there's somebody over there.
Yeah. What's your go-to boot for early season and then maybe cold weather?
Early season, I used the gum leaf rubbers. Those things are crazy comfortable. And if I'm in the mountains, I actually change because I hate cold feet. So when I hunt the mountains or even starts to get cold around here, if I'm wearing leather boots, I'll wear uninsulated leathers and the thinnest wool sock possible. And I use, I got these old, the booties there, the zip up booties.
Yeah. They're Arctic Shield.
Mine are like 15 years old, maybe even older than that. Like I got, you know, they got, what's that mossy oak? Was it Breakup? That black mossy oak camo that was just everybody bought, but like it's that camo pattern.
Okay.
And I use that and I throw like a hand warmer in there and boom, my feet are good. But as far as I wear waders a lot when it's really cold. If I got to wear rubber boots, I got some hip waders, frog togs, and I just, you know, if I got to cross any type of water, I have no problem wearing hip waders. They're warm and my feet don't get cold. And that's how I approach my boot selection now. You know, at the distance and the time of year, where I'm going to be hunting. Because having cold, like you said, cold feet, it's just, you might as well just leave. Because I just can't do it.
So are you encountering water a lot in your access routes?
Around here, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. There's not too many spots that I, you know, it's just deer, no humans, the average human isn't going to cross water.
Yeah.
So I wear hip waders and I got a pair of waist waders. I even got neoprene chest waders. I got no problem wearing them. They're super warm and comfy, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, if I sweat, I'm not going to freeze to death. So it's like a trade-off. I take them off and it's like dumping water out from sweat, but hey, I was warm.
Yeah. That's my problem is the only time I will wear rubber boots is if I know that I have an access route that is going to cross water, like a creek or into mud or something like that. But for the most part, I'm pretty lucky. You know, I hunt some river bottom ground. So unless it rains, that's the only time it's wet. But my feet, for some reason, get cold in the rubber boots, no matter how many pairs of socks or what the sock combination is. But now I do what you do. I have I wear my hiking boots. I wear some wool socks and then I put a booty over top of it.
Yep.
And
and
it works so well that I shouldn't say never, but I hardly ever wear rubber boots anymore.
Yeah, and when I do wear rubbers, you know, because I do got to cross like knee highs. I think I have a pair of dry shods. They're kind of heavy and cheap, but I'll wear still my lightweight wool sock, which is kind of annoying because the boot's so sloppy on my feet. But when I get to the tree, I'll take them off and I'll put like just another light pair of socks on.
Yeah,
because they don't breathe, and that seems to actually work better than a thick pair of socks for me.
Yeah. So, lastly here, let's talk about your, what bow are you shooting right now?
I got a Carbon Icon, Bowtech Carbon Icon.
You like it?
I bought it. I was having shoulder issues last year. I was going on elk hunt and I couldn't even pick up my bow just to lift up to shoot. So my wife gave me to go ahead to buy a new bow. And I was literally looking for the lightest bow because I was leaving for Montana in like 2 months. And I was like, I need a bow. And I went and shot one of the micro bows. Was it a gearhead?
Gearhead.
Small.
Yep.
Yeah, I got a 29-inch drawing. I just didn't like it. I'm like, this is changing too much.
Yeah.
Maybe if I had more time behind the bow, it would have worked. But I'm on crunch time. You know, I haven't really shot in like 6 months. I need a bow. And I shot a Bear Divergent, which is super short. A little too short. It's 30-inch. I didn't like that. And then I went to a shop that had these the Bowtechs. I was like, I picked it up and I had old diamond carbon riser Carbon Knight, whatever riser back in the day. I was like, I forgot about these. I picked it up, and I was like, throw a quiver and a stabilizer on there just for the weight. They put it on there. I'm like, sold. Let's pay cash for it right there. And believe it or not, it's a phenomenal bow for what I spent maybe a day and a half tuning it, and I was shooting 7 yards with broadheads,
yeah,
like instantaneous, out of the box, basically. I'm like, well, that never works out, so plus.
So and that's your bow Montana, right now?
Yeah. And for Montana, I mean, anybody that's been out west, you're walking a lot, and I'm glad I had the light bow. Like, for deer hunting around here, I threw a little more weight on it because it's too light without the quiver on, but it's still nice to be able just to walk with a lightweight bow.
Yeah, I feel you,
man. It's great. And I don't use, like, I hate wearing gloves on the riser, and I'll just wear fingerless gloves on my bow hand. I have a little hand warmer in my pocket, and I see a deer, and, I'll grab the riser. In a few minutes, it's not cold, so that's another added bonus.
Yeah. All right. So what's your arrow broadhead setup?
Day six.
Yep.
350 spines, and I'm shooting Radical Archery Designs. I shoot their titanium 3-blade and their Mad 4-blade. I like 4-blades.
Yeah, I do too.
Big cut 4-blade. There's just something about them.
What's the grains on your broadhead? 100s or 125s?
This setup, they're 100s.
Okay.
Just the way they spec'd out with the arrow. The arrow, I'm kind of borderline, like my arrows are kind of cut short just to get work with this bow because I had the arrows and I got the bow. I'm like, I'm not buying more arrows. So the arrows are kind of short and a little soft. So with the 125, so I put the 100s on there and it was, money.
Yeah.
So I'm like, sweet.
Yeah, dude. I'll tell you this. One of my favorite, I don't know if it's brands or is the Day Six arrows. Those things are freaking awesome. And I
shoot
tanks. And I shoot the 275s. And so it splits. I think they just came out with them last year, but it's right in the middle of what their offerings were last year. So I set the 275, and I think my total arrow weight was like 540 or something like that.
Yeah.
So
that's a good arrow weight for, I'm thinking I'm at like 440 or 450, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
I shoot 4-fletch.
I do too.
I think somewhere around there. And it's just a well-built arrow. Like Brian, I like his, everything that he's doing over there. Yep. It's nice.
Absolutely. He's been on this podcast before too.
Yeah. He's, good dude.
Yep.
I never met him personally, but just a little bit, I talked to him and some social media interaction. Good dude.
Yeah, absolutely. And then let's see. So we've talked about, you're a 4-fletch guy.
Yes.
Yeah. Me too.
I
don't know why, but someone told me one time, man, 4-fletch does this, and I'm just like, okay, I'm gonna do it.
Yeah, I was always, like I said, I shot 5-inch 3-flats with a massive helical because I've always liked the slick tricks. I shot them for years.
Yeah,
but they require a lot of drag. The 4-blade, the Magnum blades.
Yep.
So I shot the 5. I went to a 5-inch with a helical 3-fletch. With a massive helical, and then with the 4-fletch, I went with a smaller fletch. It's probably like the same amount of surface area as a 3-fletch, 5-inch fletch. It just makes it a little more compact sitting in the quiver than a giant massive, and they're a little bit more stiffer.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, it's nice.
Yeah.
I shot 4-fletch competing. I shot really stiff 3D arrow. So I ran a 4-fletch just for extra drag. So like my fletching was already set up for him. I'm like, I'm gonna try this straight 4-fletch, and it was like right out of the box, the 4-blade were just grouping better than the 3-fletch helical. I was like, oh, sold.
Yeah. See, I like I know what you're talking about on the 4-blade, but I shoot the Wasp Boss 4-blade, and there's something about them that I just really like. Now they're not a huge. They're more of a, I guess you would call a micro head, or something like that.
Yeah.
But they had, they have them in 100. And so my, like when, for when I go elk hunting, I want a fixed blade. Mm. And so I'll probably shoot a fixed blade depending on if I draw or not this year. I'll probably stick with a fixed blade, that Boss four blade. And then after that, if I don't draw that unit, I'll probably go back to, my jackhammers as a,
I mean, I took the four blade 1-inch cause I changed out the blades on a Madman. So I took a 1-inch four blade for elk hunting last year. And I was also shooting, I actually had a three blade 1-inch for super windy days. And I noticed a night and day difference. I mean, you got the biggest cut in the world, broadhead. If you can't actually hit what you're aiming at, it's pointless. It's useless. Yeah. So I was comfortable with shooting a 1-inch three blade. I mean, I was shooting, I mean, not to toot my own horn, but I was shooting at 70 yards. I mean, 5-inch groups with broadheads.
Wow.
Before I went to Montana with those three blades. Four blades is a little bit bigger because you're planing a little bit more. But I'm like, dude, these things are just insane. Yeah. It's like I kind of, you know, and I hunt the salt marsh a lot. And I got into ground hunting in the salt marsh. And I actually had two of those arrows in my quiver because it's always windy. And the wind drift with that three blade was minimal at best at distance. You know, at 50 yards, I'd have no problem pulling that 1-inch three blade out and letting it rip.
Yeah.
Because I know I'm going to hit, and I know I'm going to hit that pie plate. So it doesn't matter how many cuts you have; it's in the lungs that deer's going to die.
Yeah, that's a fact, man. That's a fact. Throughout the years, has there been a product that you have in your bag and that you've kept in your bag throughout the years, or a product on your bow or whatever that is just, hey man, I feel very confident with this product and I'm going to continue to use it until something better comes along?
You know, I've been shooting the same release for a few years now. It's because I shoot, it's not a hint, it's called it's a Whalen's hooker. It's like a spike release. There's no moving parts. Because I had releases break on me, calipers fail and stuff like that. So this release has no moving parts. Like I have to manipulate it to get it to go off either back tension or kind of curling my ring finger. And that thing's just, you know, it's just a great tool. I got a little strap, like a leather strap for it. And I've tried other releases. I always come back to this release.
Yeah.
As much as I'm like, I'm going to shoot a thumb trigger. This way I can like make it happen. I always come back to this hooker release. It's just like, it's just one of those things. Like it's so, you know, simple, stupid. And it just, it works for me.
Yeah.
You know, and it's easy to pull back, you know, 65 pounds. It's an easy draw. The leather strap takes the weight and I can let down. Like I'm never, you know, in a hurry, and it's a release. You can't really punch it. Like I've drawn back on deer and tried to rush a shot and the release is like, nope, you're not relaxed. You're not focused enough. So it's like, the shot won't go off, which saves me from making a bad shot. So I'll keep using it as long as, you know, it doesn't break or I lose it, you know?
Yeah.
But that thing's beat up. I mean, it looks like it got run over by a concrete truck.
Yeah, that's the, I got a couple products like that. I think on one episode, I talk about a grunt tube that I had for several years and I lost it and I was pissed because nothing sounded like it. Ripcord. There it is. Ripcord arrow rests. Yeah. For some reason, man, I just love that thing. And I don't know, man. There's a lot of really good products out there, but for some reason, I've just been kind of loving Ripcord.
Yeah, I mean, looking at my bow now, I've had the same 5-pin sight. When I worked at Cabela's, I got it at the bargain bin. And that thing's been on every bow I think I've had. I've won tournaments with it. It's nothing fancy. It's just a small pin. The pins are bright. The light always lights up. And it's like, I'll just keep using it.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got a black old sight sitting on here. I got a 2-spot hog sitting on my bench. And I have a Truglo or a Covert or whatever. It's, you know, it's basically a Truglo knockoff or a Truglo cousin.
Yeah.
It's a $40 sight at best, maybe 50.
Yeah.
And it's just works.
Awesome.
You know, it's like, keep it simple.
That's a fact, man.
Confidence is key in your equipment.
Yeah.
You know, if you're second guessing it, I tried single pin sliders and I always go back to a fixed pin.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, especially for whitetail. I mean, I took an elk hunting 7 yards. I'm like, I'm not going to shoot an elk 80 yards. I mean, I probably could, but that's a hike, man, shooting 80 yards at an animal. I don't know if I want to do that.
Yeah. I feel you, man. I'm the same way, man. Confidence in the equipment, and if it until it fails me or I find something that just blows my mind, I typically keep using it. So Well, I tell you what, man. Thanks for taking time out of your day to hop on and BS about gear with me.
Fun.
And good luck this upcoming season, man.
Yeah, you too, man.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.